Our next speaker is Helen Mountfield QC. Her biography is also in the notes and is also full of letters, both anonymised cases and acronyms, but I'm sure Helen is well known to most of us for her work in public law and human rights, and particularly in developing the law on the public sector equality duty. And Helen is going to speak about the Localism Act, Democracy versus Accountability. Thank you.
Thank you. The Localism Act is, as its title suggests, the implementation of a forceful localist political agenda personified by Eric Pickles, the Secretary of State for Community and Local Government. He said, when he introduced the bill in the House of Commons in 2010, that the object was to reverse the centralist creep of decades and replace it with local control, fundamentally shake up the balance of power in the country, revitalise local democracy, and put power back where it belongs, in the hands of the people. It's rather what the EU might call a subsidiarity principle, although I think that would bring Mr. Pickles out in a bit of a rash. He calls it power being exercised at the lowest practical level. But despite the political spin put on it in its introduction, the appeal to localism and to devolving power to a local level is actually something pretty old and pretty universal. In 1969, Lord Redcliffe Maud, who was looking at a reform of local government, said that in a period of great change, when huge unrepresentative organisations seem to control the lives of individuals and restrict personal freedom, people might be tempted to give up as a bad job the effort to master these impersonal forces. If they yielded, the loss would be irreparable. In this situation, local self-government should be a crucial influence. And he went on to say it should represent the citizen and be the means whereby he brings his views to bear on public problems that touch him most nearly. If local self-government withers, the roots of democracy grow dry. And in 1983, the Labour Party manifesto, New Hope for Britain, pledged to expand the scope for local democracy by removing the ultra vires principle and instead giving a power of general competence to all local authorities to carry out whatever activities are not expressly forbidden by statute. And indeed, that may be what the general power of well-being introduced in the Local Government Act 2000 was intended to be. But the powers in that act were not intensely used, and the Department for Community and Local Government did some research before the Localism Bill was introduced on this, and suggested that maybe this was the result of overcautious advice by risk-averse lawyers. But the more risk-averse of those lawyers may have had a point and been giving good advice, because in the litigation concerning the London Authorities Mutual Limited, the Court of Appeal held that neither Section 111 of the Local Government Act 1970 nor the General Power of Wellbeing gave a local authority power to create the kind of mutual insurance company which several local authorities had banded together to introduce, with a view to saving themselves several hundred thousand pounds worth of insurance premiums. So, and that point didn't go to the Supreme Court when that case went to the Supreme Court in 2011. The Department for Communities and Local Government noted that local authorities tended not to rely on the general power of well-being. They looked for a more specific power to act upon before they achieved their goals. So, Section 1.1 core of the Localism Act is a general power of competence for local authorities to do that which a private individual could do. So I've said introduced with support, at least over time, from all sections of the community and the Local Government Association, which is not a party political body, supported it. But some critics of the Act say that what this is going to do, far from putting control in the hands of local people, is going to divorce local government from clear and transparent accountability mechanisms and actually make it difficult for local people to challenge its actions effectively. And it's interesting that the impact assessment prepared before the Act was introduced specifically said that one impact would be to reduce legal costs for local authorities because it would reduce the number of legal challenges. But at the same time, it can be said that the Localism Act doesn't really confer power on local authorities because it fails to give local government realistic powers of local taxation or other means of raising money, which would really unfetter their wings. And indeed, the Act was not introduced in a way which could be said to promote debate or participation. There was no formal white paper before its introduction. And although the parliamentary debates are very long on assertions of the joys of local control and the delights of devolution, they say very little in terms of concrete explanations as to why this Act is either necessary or desirable. But the Department for Community and Local Government has produced what it called a plain English guide to the Localism Act, and it divides the way the Act works into four strands. One is called New Freedoms and Flexibility for Local Government. One is called New Rights and Powers for Communities. The third is reform of the planning system, which we're told is going to make it clearer, more democratic and more effective. And the fourth is ensuring that housing decisions are taken locally and in very short form. And that means that local authorities will be able to meet their housing obligations by giving short hold tenancies in the private sector anywhere in the country. It also contains, controversially, although it's not mentioned at all in the plain English guide, a power for central government to impose the financial consequences of breaches of EU law by local authorities on those bodies. And all those aspects of the Act are significant and have generated a lot of debate among the specialist lawyers dealing with those areas. But I'm going to focus, and particularly given that Diane's asked me to try and help make up the time, particularly on the general power of competence, and then perhaps touch a little bit on the various new rights and powers for communities and what those will do for the structure of local government decision-making and the structure of accountability. So starting with the general power of competence, it is, as I've said, a power for local authorities in England, at least to do anything that individuals generally may do, and it replaces the general power of well-being. And it was brought into force on the 18th of February, rather earlier than was first planned. It was planned that it was going to come into force in April, but it was rushed into force by Eric Pickles and a statutory instrument because of the judgment of Mr Justice Ouseley in the case of the National Secular Society in Bideford Town Council, a challenge brought by my colleagues David Wolfe and Claire Darwin on behalf of the National Secular Society. And that was handed down just 8 days earlier on the 10th of February. And that was a case in which Bideford Town Council, a rather small body, held prayers, sometimes Christian prayers and sometimes Quaker prayers, before council meetings. But they didn't form part of the formal business of the council meetings. And that was challenged on the basis that the council required statutory authority to do anything that it did, and it didn't have any. And although Mr Justice Ouseley was not very impressed with the Article 9 type arguments that were put before him, he said that those prayers were illegal because there was no express statutory authority for them to be held. The only possible power, source of power, was Section 111 of the Local Government Act 1972, and he said that the holding of prayers was not calculated to facilitate or conducive or incidental to the discharge of any of the council's functions. So Eric Pickles said that this was disappointing. This was the very sort of thing that the general power of competence was intended to end, apparently, or to permit. And so this was brought into force a bit earlier. And the guidance on the general power of competence said that this turned upside down the conventional assumptions about local authorities' powers and responsibilities being defined by legislation. He said instead of that, instead of being able to act only where the law says they can, local authorities will be freed to do anything, provided they don't break other laws. Now, those of a nervous disposition may be pleased to know that the impact assessment on the general power gave as a possibly slightly unrealistic example of something local councillors would not be able to do as waging thermonuclear war. And you'll be pleased to learn that the reason they can't do that is it's prohibited by the Nuclear Materials Offences Act 1983, the Nuclear Safeguards Act 2000, and the Environmental Permitting England and Wales Regulations 2010. Perhaps more realistically, local authorities engaged in provision of financial services can only do that if they're still regulated by the regulatory regime set out by the Financial Services Authority. So it's a general power to do anything that an individual can do which is not specifically prohibited, but but not the power to get the funds to do it with, or power to acquire those funds directly from local government electors, because they will not, for example, be able to impose new taxes as an individual has no power to tax. So the various kind of innovative solutions which have been suggested, like the provision of financial services or state agent services, because local authorities know their area very well, those can only be conducted through wholly owned local government companies, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But the general power of competence is not boundless, and Section 2 of the Act sets out the boundaries to the power, and they're quite tight, and they're also, I think, going to be controversial. Section 2 provides that the general power doesn't apply to those things which the authority is unable to do by virtue of a pre-commencement limitation or a post-commencement limitation which is expressed to apply to the general power, to all the authority's powers, or to all the authority's powers with exceptions excluding the general power. And what I think that's meant to mean is that if you have an existing power to act, but subject to limitations, you can't just ignore the limitations and say, well, we're not doing it under that power, we're doing it under the general power of competence, so we'll do it however we want. And that will continue in relation to post-enactment, post-commencement limitations, unless those are expressed not to apply to the general power. But how far that goes, I think, is a very moot point, and certainly there are differing views expressed by the opposing parties to the litigation as to whether the general competence power would enable Bideford Town Council to reinstate its pre-meeting prayers. The general power doesn't allow local authorities to make or alter governance arrangements or to contract out or delegate the discharge of their functions to committees or officers. Although, again, how that interacts with what's known as a community right of challenge may be a difficult issue, and I'll come back to that. But you can't have creative new arrangements for discharging functions using stakeholder boards or privatised entities. There are some specific powers in the Act to broaden council's powers to run area committees and so on, but they don't go very far. But curiously, for a measure that is intended to devolve power to the people, Section 5 of the Localism Act allows the Secretary of State, using Henry VIII provisions, to amend, repeal, revoke, or disapply any statutory provision which he thinks prevents or restricts local authorities from exercising the general power of competence or which overlaps with it. So if the Secretary of State thinks that a pre-existing limitation on a statutory power shouldn't exist, well, he doesn't have to change the law on that. He can by primary legislation, he can use Henry VIII powers to do away with it, although he does have to consult in certain circumstances. And there are a number of limitations on his power, which include, in particular, that he can't remove those pre-existing restrictions if the provision is of constitutional significance. So again, discuss what that means in the context of Henry VIII powers. But despite all those restrictions and exceptions and the conferral of Henry VIII powers, the Secretary of State, or the DCLG guidance says that this will give local authorities increased confidence to do creative, innovative things to meet local people's needs. And those with long memories will think back to the last time cash-strapped local authorities tried to do innovative and creative things to meet local people's needs, and what happened with all the interest rate swaps in the late 80s and early 1990s. Because there may well be a temptation for local authorities and being called upon to do more, but with no more power to raise funds, to exercise their general power to do that which a competent adult can do, and gamble. And the department recognises that local authorities could act in a riskier way than they do at the moment, but thinks that the power of the ballot box will be enough to prevent that. But although the other anticipation is that this will reduce judicial review, it's at least possible that while the contours of the prohibitions on the use of the general power are developed, there may be a rash of new improper purpose judicial reviews as local authorities are challenged on the use of the power of general competence, which it said conflict with functions more properly implemented through other legislation or with the limitations imposed upon them. The second general point I want to talk about is the effect of the general power of competence on local government finance. Some people have said that the general power of competence is going to muddy the waters as to the extent of local authority power or the scope of the proper business of local government. But others say it's going to put a whole lot more responsibility on local authorities, but make it very difficult for them to generate new funds. So I've noted already that they can't raise new local taxes. But the Localism Act changes one of the major fetters on local government power, which is the capping which central government has previously been able to impose on council tax rises if they are above the level which central government thinks is proper. Now, that's abolished by the Localism Act. The Localism Act permits local authorities to raise council tax above the level set by central government, but only if that rise is approved, expressly approved, in a local referendum. And you might fairly ask, if the real aim is to devolve power to local authorities, why isn't a local government election a sufficient opportunity for electors to choose the package, both of services which they wish their local authorities to provide and the charges which they wish to make for them, as happens in a national election? After all, nobody votes in a separate referendum on income tax rises. Likewise, a local authority doesn't have power, won't have power under the Localism Act to increase local business rates, but it will have power to reduce them or to offer group discounts to particular groups of businesses to encourage them to come into the area. And that is untrammelled by the need for a referendum. There's also an issue about the extent to which the general power can be used to charge for provision of public services, and that's set out in Section 3 of the Act. Local authorities can't use the general power to charge for services which a statutory provision requires them to provide, unless there's specific statutory power for that. But nor can it charge for services provided without a person's agreement. Nor can it charge for services provided in the exercise of a statutory discretion more than it costs them to provide those services. So it can't make a profit out of them. But that's rather puzzling, because it does have a power to use the general power for general commercial purposes, provided it acts through a company, but it can only do so if the things it proposes to do are things which it may, in the exercise of the general power, do otherwise for commercial purposes. So it's very difficult to see what is the discretionary service that a local authority is now able to provide, perhaps using the general power of competence, but which is commercial, not discretionary, and from which, therefore, the local authority can attempt to make a profit. So it may well be thought that local authorities have been given the theoretical means to extend their powers, but not the wherewithal to do so. I'm going to touch very briefly on some other areas in the Act which interact with the general power of competence. One is EU financial sanctions, and I've already said it's odd that that isn't mentioned at all in the plain English guide to the Localism Act. But here's a part of the Act that's not yet in force. But Part 2 of the Act gives a Minister of the Crown discretionary power to require a public authority to pay all or part of a financial sanction imposed on the UK and by the Court of Justice. And the rationale for that is that if one local authority breaches its obligations under the RACE directive, why should the rest of the country pay for it if that local authority has it in its hands to cure it? So again, you can see the prospect of legal actions where local authorities challenge the imposition upon them of financial sanctions by a Minister of the Crown. There are various other important governance provisions in the Localism Act. One is the abolition of the Standards Board, which regulates standards of behaviour in public life. The government thought that was abused by the making of petty complaints, so local authorities can now make and police their own codes of conduct. But deliberately withholding or misrepresenting a financial interest is now going to be a criminal offence. So there's an upping of the stakes on what's seen as the very important points and a lowering of the stakes on the others. Section 25 of the Act clarifies the rules which actually were already there in judge-made law on predetermination. I can't be the only person in the room who is familiar with people coming in the course of a judicial review challenge and saying, look, Councillor so-and-so said he thought this decision was a good idea 3 weeks before it was taken. That proves he was biased and had a closed mind. And the courts have said in the past, no, one expects local politicians to have policy statements and positions on things. It's just important when they're acting in a quasi-judicial way that they are open to other considerations. But that's put on a statutory footing by Section 25 of the Localism Act. There was a power, there is a power, for mayoral referenda, and the government used that power and triggered those referenda this May in England's 11 largest cities, but only one, Bristol, said it wanted an elected mayor, although Doncaster voted to keep its own. The other important provisions that I'm just going to touch on, which are not the housing and planning bits, which are large topics of their own, are the new rights and powers for communities to express interest in running public services. This is the famous John Lewis model. One's seen in various recent judicial reviews, for example, challenges to library closures, and that one of the features in the age of austerity is local people who say, perhaps not, I want to run public services, but I will run these services if the option is that they otherwise disappear. And Chapter 2 of the Localism Act contains a community right to challenge. And what that is permission for a community group, a parish council, a group of local authority employees or others to express an interest in taking over the running of a local authority service. And that group can generate a service provided it's used only for the plough back into those activities or invested in the community. And if there is such an expression of interest, then the local authority must consider it. And if it accepts that this is a service which could be run by an outside body or group in this way, then it must run a procurement exercise for the service in which the challenging organisation can bid. Now, it's interesting that you don't have to have a referendum for that. There could be a large area of public authority service that was put out to tender in this way. And I'm not aware that the legislation sets a time limit on how long it would be that the body could run that service. But this is one feature of the Act, which may be a major change if it's extensively used, may not actually change very much, but it could lead to devolution of power to local people, or it could be a really serious attack on accountability if one then gets into are you a public body type challenges. And connected to that, although not necessarily entirely overlapping, is the right improved rights to bid for what are known as assets of community value. And again, as the recession has bitten and there have been significant cuts to local authority budgets, many buildings which have played a role in community life, whether they're publicly owned or privately owned, have been threatened with closure. So community centres, libraries, swimming pools, village shops, markets, pubs. And Chapter 3 of the Localism Act, which came into force very recently on the 21st of September, is designed to strengthen the hand of community groups which wish to take over such amenities, because they often need more time to organise a bid and raise money than a private enterprise might bidding against them. So there's a new duty on a local authority to maintain a list of assets of community value nominated by the local community. And what it means is that if people in the community make a case that this is building has been used for public purposes, and they have to make the case for what is a public purpose. And I think the last 5 years, and could realistically be used again for that purpose in the last 5 years, it should go on the list of assets for community value. Assets of community value. If the owner of that building then wants to dispose of it, there's an interim moratorium period of 6 weeks. The seller has to notify the local authority of its intention to dispose of the land, then the 6 weeks when they can't, during which a community group could put in a written request to be treated as a potential bidder, and if there is such a request, then the intended seller is not allowed to dispose of the land for 6 months
after the notification of the intention, and that written notification means they can't dispose of the land without going through the whole process again for 18 months. So the idea is that these community groups will have time to develop a bid, but the owner of the land can ask the authority to review its decision to have the asset on the list of community assets, and you can envisage judicial reviews of decisions to include the asset on the list and the land on the list, and perhaps less likely given the resource implications to take it off. Certainly envisage challenges to the decision to have it on the register, less likely that the community groups are going to have the wherewithal to challenge taking it off. One also wonders how willing local authorities are going to be to list buildings. It's a discretionary decision, and there is a power for the Secretary of State to make regulations, although they're not enforced yet, requiring the paying of compensation to a private owner whose building is included on the list. And at the moment, there isn't a sanction against owners of land who just sell anyway before the moratorium period is over, or there is a power to make regulations for such a sanction. So the government considers that the Localism Act is a radical agenda for change, offering power to the people at local level, unshackling local government from the centralising power of Whitehall, and enabling services to be creatively tailored to local needs. Others think that there's a real risk that local authority functions and assets will be taken over in a very untransparent way by unaccountable privately operated groups, and it'll be difficult to identify who is operating what power and how, and that the general power of competence will eclipse local people's ability genuinely to hold local government into account. I think the devil really will be in the detail and whether this does change the culture in hard-pressed local authorities. I'm going to just finish with the director of the Local Government Information Unit, who's a think tank. He's called Jonathan Carr West, and he said, well, it's an odd bill. It could be hugely transformative, but it might not be. It's not badly drafted. It's just trying to do some very complicated things. I think the Localism Act will do for local government officers and councillors and service users and administrative lawyers is make us live in interesting times.
Thank you.